You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 28th of July 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
US Congress attempts to understand what nearly happened to it on January 6th.
The UK eases some inbound travel restrictions, but is anybody welcoming the outbound British?
And as Croatia stokes an old rivalry with Serbia, what could go wrong? A wider look at petty neighbourly disputes. I'm Andrew Muller.
And I'm Chris Chermak. The Monocle Daily, in association with Allianz, starts now.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller.
And I'm Chris Chermak. Our guests today, Natalia Sobrevia-Perea and Stephen Diel, will discuss the day's big stories. And we'll have the latest in our series looking at the Olympics from a variety of national perspectives. Today, it's Italy.
Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller.
And I'm Chris Chermak.
And we are joined today in a jam-packed studio by Stephen Diel, who is a writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst, and also by Natalia Sobrevia-Perea, who is a professor of Latin American history at the University of Kent. I feel like I need to welcome pretty much everybody here. Well, not you, Stephen, obviously. You're a fairly regular guest here on the Daily. We're used to you by now. But welcome to Chris Chermak, who has sat in that chair many times before as a pundit / guest on this show, but is now here as co-host.
Exactly. I'm trying on my co-host presenter hat for a change. I've been doing that a bit in the last week and a half or so, so I look forward to it.
We are, just to make it clear to listeners, making Chris literally wear the co-presenter hat, which has just got massive novelty antlers sticking out the side of it. And also Natalia Sobrevia-Perea, who joins us for the first time on the Daily, but has spoken to us frequently about Latin American affairs, including trying to make sense of Peru's bizarre run of gutterballs with presidents, which we will be talking more about later in the show. But welcome, Natalia.
Good to be back.
Well, we will start today's show, however, in Washington, D.C., where a congressional committee has been investigating the events of January 6th, when a mob of supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building as legislators voted to endorse the results of last November's presidential election.
Now, the inquiry is being led almost entirely by Democrats after the two parties, Republicans and Democrats, lawmakers could not agree on which politicians would actually sit on this congressional committee. That shouldn't stop us from hopefully learning something valuable about what happened on that day and how to prevent it from ever happening again. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Suzanne Lynch from the Irish Times to talk a bit more about this. Now, Suzanne, we heard from Capitol Police officers in particular on Tuesday. Have we learned anything new so far, and what can we expect going forward?
Yeah, it was pretty a somber tone in the U.S. Capitol. This was the first day of this committee hearing, and we heard from four police officers who were there on the day, and they described in very emotional and frank terms what they went through that day. One police officer, Sergeant Aquilino Gonnell, he talked about how he believed he was going to die. He said, "This is how I'm going to die." He described how he would feel himself losing oxygen as he was crushed by the crowd. He said he had been in Iraq and he had seen nothing. He never felt as scared as he had been on that day. Another officer, Michael Fanone, described how the Trump supporters seized the shields of police officers and used them to attack the officers there, how they threatened to take his own gun and shoot him with it. And then he described how he yelled to them, "You know, I have kids," and eventually was drawn away. He was knocked unconscious. So these were the kind of really visceral real life stories that were told over several hours yesterday in the Capitol, and really, I think, brought everyone back to those events on January the 6th.
Suzanne, one of the many wretched ironies at large here is that it's traditionally the Republicans who are the party of law and order, Blue Lives Matter, etc., etc. Is there any indication that any of that extraordinarily stark testimony by those Capitol Police officers has embarrassed anybody into shifting their position on this?
I don't think so. Interestingly, just before proceedings got underway yesterday, the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, who had clashed with Pelosi about who should be on the committee, as you explained there at the outset, he actually blamed Nancy Pelosi for what happened. He held a press conference with some other Republicans saying, you know, the leadership, this happened because of leadership at the top. Elise Stefanik, who took over from Liz Cheney, her leadership position in the Republican Party, she said that Nancy Pelosi bears responsibility for what occurred, saying that there were security breaches that should have been foreseen. Now, obviously, this is going to be an element of it. How did this huge security failing happen? But it is obviously really noteworthy that none of the Republicans mentioned Donald Trump in this and instead thought to blame Nancy Pelosi for a riot that was instigated and was completely orchestrated by Trump supporters.
Well, Suzanne, as you mentioned there is a real security aspect of this. You know, there is something that we would like to learn in order to prevent something like this from happening again. Talk us through a little bit what might be happening going forward. Can we expect, despite this, the struggle over, you know, the credibility, the infighting between Republicans and Democrats, can we glean anything from this going forward? What kind of people are we going to be hearing from?
Yeah, so Betty Thompson, the chair of the committee, kind of updated the media after this hearing. So, you know, we're heading into August here in the US Capitol, and we don't expect much from this committee imminently. But he did say that lawmakers could be recalled early in August to continue this hearing. As he said, there's going to be an update in the next few days about who might appear. Now, you're right in that maybe there are two Republicans on the committee, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. They are anti-Trump Republicans. But we could see them, I'd say, as this continues into the autumn, maybe probing the issue of security, like who knew what, who was responsible for this. So I think that is going to be one important aspect. Again, another thing to watch for is whether any members of the Trump administration or Trump himself could be subpoenaed to appear. Now, if that was to happen, Trump would probably cite executive privilege and some kind of legal wrangling would ensue. But I think it's quite possible that members of the Trump administration, maybe who were in the White House that day, maybe Republican members like Kevin McCarthy, who allegedly spoke to Donald Trump at some point during the day, they could be forced to give their side of events. So look, only at the beginning of this process, but there's a lot left to run.
A lot left to run, and will be very interesting to see what kind of guests appear before that panel, as you talked about there. Suzanne Lynch in Washington, D.C., thank you very much. Now, it's been a long time for transatlanticists and Europhiles in the UK, but Downing Street finally does plan to ease travel restrictions for doubly vaccinated residents hoping to travel to the United States or the European Union, allowing them to return to the UK without the need for quarantining. Personally, as an American, I'm looking very much forward to going home this summer, I have to say, so this is fantastic news.
Aside from my co-host, airlines in the UK are also welcoming the move, but this is not the final hurdle. The US has yet to agree to a reciprocal arrangement, meaning Americans could be allowed to bathe on the UK's sunny shores. And yes, I am being sarcastic, the weather in this country is ridiculous, but Brits might still be barred from soaking up the sun at Miami Beach or Disneyland. Well, let's go to our panel on this. Natalia, first of all, are you suddenly now excited to get back on a plane if you can find a destination that will have you?
Well, I've actually been to the US twice already because...
Now you're just showing off.
No, my parents are American and they live there. And I've just literally come back last week from California. So it's very difficult to get on a plane. I've had to show papers, birth certificates. You really feel unwelcome, even if you do have the right paperwork. And it's interesting to me that none of this was clear to me before I traveled. So at the airport, they were suddenly saying, well, if you don't have your birth certificate, you're not allowed on the plane.
A birth certificate? Really? Who even has their birth certificate? I wouldn't know where to start looking for mine.
Well, luckily, when you're Peruvian, as well as all the other things, you do have it at hand.
Stephen, what about you, to bring you in on this? Have you been able to take advantage already in some way? Are you looking forward to going anywhere in particular?
I'm very much looking forward to going back to my native Scotland next month. And that's been, we planned that months and months ago. We've booked everything. I'm sounding terribly smug, I know. I mean, I, as much as anyone, enjoy travelling. I think it was in 2017 that I racked up 15 different European countries in the one year. And in 2018, I was in the States and in Canada. But to be honest, you know, it's a pandemic. And I'm quite happy to stay on this little island for the time being. And anyone who hasn't been to Scotland should go. And anyone who has been to Scotland, particularly in the summer, will understand why I'm keen to get back there.
I think that's a good point. Do you feel like many people actually are on staycations at this point? I mean, is that where you're thinking rather than taking advantage now all of a sudden about, you know, EU or other travel?
Yeah, no, it was 7 or 8 months ago, I think we decided, right, you know, we don't know where this thing's going with the pandemic. We love Scotland. Let's just go to Scotland this summer. So as I say, we booked up everything a long time ago, and I'm really looking forward to it. I will look forward in different circumstances to getting on a plane again, and hopefully, you know, not having to wear a mask all the way across the Atlantic, for example. I don't think that those times are coming anytime really soon.
Natalia, as somebody who has recently visited the United States, did you get a sense of why the US government is being a little less urgent about this than the UK is? Do they feel under less pressure? I mean, famously, Americans don't travel as much as Europeans. Do US authorities perhaps feel under less pressure from their own people to find some way to let us out of here?
I really do not understand, because South Americans have been flooding to the United States, mainly to take advantage of vaccination possibilities there. They've been traveling without any restrictions. So when I kept saying it was impossible for me to go in any easy way, everyone in South America was surprised that it was so difficult for Europeans to get to the U.S. So it seems to be like a non-issue. They kind of don't even think of it. They're not even bothered by it in the U.S.,
I heard recently from a great friend of mine in America who told me that he'd just come back from a holiday to Portugal and had planned originally to come here as well, but couldn't. And I told him, it reminded me of the story from 1980 of the American ambassador in Moscow talking to the Russian Soviet foreign minister just after the invasion of Afghanistan. And he said to the Soviet foreign minister, so how big is the USSR? And the mumbled answer, and he said, "Oh, not big enough for you, eh?" And this is what I said to my friend in America: "What, you know, you had to come to Portugal because what, America's not big enough for holiday?" I was a little surprised that Americans, I know Americans want to come to Europe, but there are plenty of places, presumably now, they can go on holiday in their own country, and they can get sun, and they can get mountains, and they can get all sorts of scenery. I think, you know, we really are not out of this pandemic yet. I'm not wishing to be completely pessimistic, but cases are still rising. Vaccinations in this country are doing pretty well. In America, it's only about 50%, I believe, and it depends on different states as well. Vaccinations, it seems, work, and until more people are vaccinated, then I think travel is still going to be something that we're going to be rather wary of.
Well, it's been really interesting to watch, hasn't it, both the vaccination and how that's gone along in different parts of the world, but then also, like, as we're talking about, how different each country or continent has dealt with travel restrictions, when to ease them, how to ease them. As you talked about there, the European Union has been quite a bit faster, it feels like, than many in easing, at least within the European Union. And Natalia, perhaps you can tell us a little about also within Latin America, how has that been going? Would you say, are they more similar to the EU, more to the US? You talked about them coming to the US itself. What about within Latin America?
Well, it's very strange because, for instance, it would be impossible for me to go to my native Peru without quarantining in a hotel when I came back to the UK, unless I spent 10 days in the US in between. In the US, it seems everybody is taking it quite easy. You can pick up a vaccination anywhere, children 12 and up. So it's very much about people deciding to get vaccinated. Vaccines are widely available, whereas in this country, children 12 and up cannot be vaccinated yet. And in South America, it really depends on the country. And wealthy have taken advantage of the possibilities of going to the US for vaccine tourism. And that's also quite interesting. The way in which people are living the pandemic in the US is very different. They're much more relaxed. I was in LA when they reintroduced the mask mandate, and people were just very, very at ease, even though they knew the Delta variant was growing, that young people are not getting vaccinated in the right amounts of numbers. So I see a lot of variation of how different societies are dealing with this.
Just a final very quick thought on this subject before we move on, Stephen. Just in light of what you were saying about vacationing in Scotland this year, I think all, you know, those of us who have lived in recent years, having been born with the right passport, have become accustomed to more or less traipsing around the world as we please. And as Natalia was demonstrating, it has now become far more complicated and difficult. Do you think that that's going to put people off in significant numbers of travelling for pleasure, that a kind of sod it, who can be bothered thing is going to kick in?
Well, I mean, I think it'll put people off from travelling. But you say travelling for pleasure. I mean, I would be delighted to go to Scotland. I mean, seriously, you know, even if I could, if I had a choice of places to go, I think the Highlands of Scotland would be very high up on my list at any time. So, you know, I think one of the things that's happened is this word, this awful word, I think, that's come up, staycation, and it's got negative connotations. I'm glad you said my vacation to Scotland, because it is. It's going to be a holiday, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, I think on that point, it's interesting that all of us will, first of all, perhaps be trying to go home to wherever we come from, which is part of my effort as well to get back to the US in August. But that is also a good way to segue into our next topic, particularly for you, Natalia. Peru, which has a new president as of today, Pedro Castillo, was sworn in today, 2 months after a desperately close election in which the left-wingers saw off Keiko Fujimori, daughter of the imprisoned former President Alberto Fujimori.
Yes, President Castillo will be hoping to end an astonishing sequence of mishap and misfortune which has befallen occupants of the government palace in Lima. Several recent Peruvian presidencies have ended in impeachment, jail, exile, death, or some combination of the above. So, Natalia, let's start with President Castillo's, as he now is, chances of making it to, let's not put too much pressure on him, his chances of making it to, say, this time next week.
Well, the Congress that is led by the opposition has kind of already shown some bravado today by preventing the outgoing President Sagasti to go into Congress to the ceremony, claiming that he was usurping the position because he was just a caretaker government. They need 8 votes to get to oust him, and it is anybody's guess when they're going to use that wild card. They are saying that the new president of Congress, she supported one of the coups in November. She's from the same party. She has said that she will try to ensure that Congress remains independent, but we will see. Some people are saying if he makes it to Christmas, it will be amazing.
I always find it amazing in these things that, you know, not so different sometimes from the discussions we've had in the U.S., that the policy side gets completely lost when you have such political deadlock. Is there any sense, do you feel, that there's something that these two sides can work on for however long he is in power?
We have to hope that they continue with the great vaccination program that President Sagasti put forward. When he took over in November, there was not a single vaccine that had been purchased in Peru. And today we're having people under 40 being vaccinated. He's done an amazing job, and we're hoping. He says that now he's bought enough doses so anybody above 12 can be vaccinated between now and December. But this will only happen if we have the political will and some stability.
Stephen, as a general principle, not just in Peru, but anywhere, how damaging to the credibility of institutions is a run of outs like the one Peru has had with its presidency? Does there come a tipping point at which people start to think, okay, this is not a glitch and this is not a bad stroke of luck? This is something fundamental and structural, and to the extent that people sort of just lose faith in the entire arrangement?
I'm sure there is. I think what you've just said at the end there, that people lose faith. People lose faith in their institutions. We've had in this country, it's been, there's been some turbulent times since 2016, since the EU referendum. And there's an awful lot of cynicism around. But, you know, people generally have stuck with one party. Some people say we're like a one party state, in fact, because our two parties are in such a mess, the Conservatives and the Labour Party. Labour Party still trying to get over the Corbynites. I was talking to a member of the Labour Party the other day who said, well, basically, it's still our problems are within the party. It's between the moderates and the extremists. And we're still trying to get rid of the extremists, the Corbynites, which means that they can't act as a proper opposition. So that, again, it's a situation in this country which is losing people's confidence. But I would imagine, and obviously Natalia is far better qualified to comment on this, but I mean, I would imagine in a country where you've had, I think I'm right in saying, four presidents in the last 5 years, and the winning margin this time, it's less than 1%, I think. It's something like 18,000 votes out of 40 million in Peru that elected the president. That and with the Congress being against him as well, interesting that Natalia said, you know, people are hoping if he'll do well if he gets to Christmas. I mean, I'm not a gambling man, but if I were, I wouldn't put money on him being there in 2022.
Natalia, maybe to that point, it strikes me, I'd be curious to what extent you feel that the voters and the public in Peru, is this a case of disaffection with government, no political leaders that they feel are qualified and they're tired of the infighting, or are they also just so polarized at this point, if you will, between competing ideologies that they can't see a way through this?
It's a combination of things. And also, one thing that we have to remember is that this is also a very corrupt system, a system that is funded by narco interests, by a lot of illegal economies. And the right wing, Keiko Fujimori in particular, took every single step from Trump's playbook. And she's questioned the legitimacy of the election all throughout. And she has convinced her supporters that this is not a legitimate government. And that is very dangerous.
And just on that as well, Natalia, because I think it bewilders a lot of passing observers of Peruvian politics, and it certainly confuses me, is how is it that the Fujimori name, which you would think had been tarnished to the point of opacity by the fact that the patriarch of the family is still serving an interminable prison sentence for more offences than I have time here to list, how is that still a thing? How are you able to run for office and, as Stephen pointed out, go within a whisker of winning it with that surname? It's like, it seems like it would be like running for president of Romania called Ceausescu.
Pretty much. But also, it's the second time that she was defeated by a whisker. So the Fujimori name has a lot of clout. He was very successful in the 1990s. He defeated the Shining Path. He turned over the economy. And he did it in a very corrupt way. And that there's some winners and some losers. And the winners are still winning. So they will keep on supporting him.
Stephen, maybe on the subject also of using Trump's playbook, if you will, is this something, what's your feeling on just that, on particularly this questioning of elections? We've now seen it in Peru. We obviously saw it in the United States. Is this spreading, do you feel? I mean, you're obviously a Russia expert as well, where perhaps this has always been a bit more par for the course. But is this kind of rhetoric seeping in a new and different way? Is it something, it feels like something very easy to take advantage of almost these days?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the most dangerous phrases I've heard lately is that if it's trending, it's true. You know, social media has got such a grip now that if someone starts something running, then, oh, well, there are these people out there who believe it must be true. And that, I think, is worrying for any country. Interestingly, in Russia, where you've, of course, they would say, or at least Putin would say, they've had stability. But what that's happened is that people have become so distrustful of their government that they just shrug their shoulders. And so without having a constant change of leadership, they have also become very cynical and not believing what the government says. So I think this is a trend. And it is actually a very worrying trend, I think, worldwide.
Stephen Diel and Natalia Sobrevia-Pareja, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you shortly. This is The Daily. We'll be back right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Another core principle at Allianz is a belief in equality of opportunity and that diversity makes a company more innovative, more resilient, and better equipped for the future. Renata Wagner is the board member at Allianz responsible for mergers and acquisitions, human resources, group legal, group compliance, and group data protection. With that broad portfolio, Renata has a pretty unique perspective on how those Allianz core values shape the company's approach. Renata is with us today to tell us about how Allianz is addressing an incredibly complex and sensitive subject, mental health. Renata Wagner, thanks for being with us. Previously, Renata, you spoke about resilience. We return to the theme and the broader point about confidence in tomorrow. But if we look at the Olympics and Paralympics, how does Allianz support athletes on their path to success? Or maybe in some cases, ultimately even to failure on that biggest stage? There's that truism, I guess, about learning more from failures, in fact, than one does from successes. So what does Allianz's support for athletes? What does that actually look like?
First of all, we want to give the athletes the opportunity to inspire the world. And we will support them in a number of ways, including, you know, working on insurance solutions and services for the movements, in helping these athletes to prepare for life after the competition through an interactive mentoring program, for example, and also by working with these athletes as ambassadors around the world. So many of our employees have worked long and hard to make this partnership possible, and now to see the company-wide excitement is something very special. And these teams at Allianz now have the unique opportunity to support the athletes as well.
Renata Wagner on Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Allianz, confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller with Chris Chermak, and still with us are our guests Natalia Sobrevia-Perea and Stephen Diel. It has been a busy week for high-stakes, big-power US diplomacy. First, there was a meeting between deputy foreign ministers of the US and China on Monday, and in New Delhi today, a meeting between US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
And as if that were not enough, there's also a follow-up meeting in Geneva today between senior officials from the United States and Russia. This comes after a summit between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin in June, which was seen as a positive, at least for the fact that the two leaders, despite their many differences, seem to actually not mind each other's company. Today in Geneva, it's down to business, turning that bonhomie into actual substantive progress, with a meeting on the topic of arms control. Stephen, let's turn to you on this. First of all, tell us a little about what the US and Russian officials are talking about today and what we can expect.
It's a gradual cranking up of the process, I suppose you might say, of which hopefully will lead to a new START deal, strategic arms reduction talks. Russia earlier this year agreed that it's necessary. The Americans, of course, have many more nuclear missiles than Russia, even though Russia has a lot, but America's got more. It's a one-day meeting following on, as you say, from the meeting 6 weeks ago between Presidents Biden and Putin. I think that there was a quotation which I've got here, and I will cut it down a bit, but it was something that President Biden said yesterday, actually, in the White House. He said, "I had just had an interesting meeting, as you know, with my very close friend, Vladimir Putin." I think that was said tongue-in-cheek. "He knows that you're better talking to his team. You're better than his team, and it bothers the hell out of him. Not a joke. And then he went on to say, "When I was with Mr. Putin, he has a real problem. He's sitting on top of an economy that has nuclear weapons and oil wells and nothing else. He knows he's in real trouble, which makes him even more dangerous in my view." Now, that to me was very, it was in part of a long, much longer speech that he made, but those were, I took out of it. And that idea that he sees Putin as, if Putin feels weak, he's dangerous. And he's got nuclear weapons. And that, to me, is a really driving factor behind what's happening today in Geneva and what will go on now. Why, and also why Biden agreed to meet Putin in the first place. And amidst some criticism, people said, you know, why? What are you going to get from him? You know, we've got sanctions against Russia. Yeah, he's behaving outrageously. He invaded Ukraine and so on. And I think that this is the nub of it. He realizes that because Russia is a major nuclear power too, it may be a country with a very poor economy. And you know, as one of his predecessors, President Obama said, you know, what would you want to buy from Russia? And it's got oil and missiles and that's it. And that's basically what Biden's saying again. But it's that, particularly the missiles, are really important. And I think I actually find this very encouraging that the Americans are behaving in a grown-up way and saying we can't just not talk to Russia. We need to talk to them, particularly about missiles. And so that's really what the meeting today in itself, it won't achieve anything great, but it's another step along the way, possibly to a new strategic arms reduction treaty.
Stephen, just to follow that up, does it strike you that the change in US presidency has actually changed the relationship between the two countries? Because the relationship between the two men is obviously very different for reasons that we have not yet perhaps got entirely to the bottom of. President Trump was always extremely deferential, that seems like a tactful word to use, but deferential towards President Putin, whereas President Biden, as you have just amply demonstrated, is not.
I think it is a new era, even I would go so far as to say that, or at least it's returned to the old ways. I mean, it's almost, you know, just saying the words President Biden, it's just sounds so nice generally. I mean, that sort of 4 years sounds like a bad dream when we talked. I'm not even going to say that other guy who was there. I mean, it's just a horrible thought. I think we are still going to hear sometime in the future, something is going to come out somewhere, possibly in some little American newspaper somewhere, it'll be leaked, exactly what it was that Putin had on Trump. Putin definitely had something on Trump. Trump, he criticized everyone except for Putin. He never, in 4 years, he never criticized Putin publicly. He had a go at the European Union leaders. He had a go, you know, all America's allies, but he kept quiet about Putin. And I'm sure that there is something that Putin had on him. There was some papers appear to have come to light recently suggesting that the Russians actually were planning well ahead to do everything to ensure that Trump became president. And I think that one's not dead. We're going to hear more about that.
Natalia, maybe to bring you in quickly on this as well. It interests me that Latin America, you know, certainly used to be this almost playground between the US and Russia in the Cold War era. Is there any semblance of that still today? Is Latin America watching a meeting like this closely?
Well, of course. And we haven't really spoken about what's happening in Cuba. And this is really kind of where the Cold War still is. Cold or hot, I don't know how to call it. There's a lot of talk about the embargo. I mean, the Russians haven't been involved with Cuba for a very long time, but the crisis in Cuba is now similar to the one in the special period after the fall of the Soviet Union. But going back to Trump's obsession with power, he was also quite deferential to North Korea's leader. He seems to like strong leaders.
Although he did criticize him. I mean, he called him Little Rocket Man before he met him, so...
Yeah, but still, he had something for them, didn't he?
Well, let's move along slightly, well, indeed quite a lot, though there's a semi-seamless link here, to another curious pillar of the human condition, which is that those peoples we most dislike, or affect to most dislike, are often the ones who are closest to us, geographically or otherwise. Do not, for example, get me, an Australian, started on those treacherous weirdos from New Zealand.
Croatia and Serbia have never needed much of an excuse to get angry with each other, and a row has been predictably inflamed by the announcement of Croatia's national bank that it will be adorning new coins with an image of the great inventor Nikola Tesla, who, to cut a long story short, Serbia believes was Serbian and has named Belgrade's airport after him accordingly. Maybe Stephen, to start with you, what do you make of this? Is Croatia just trying to get in Serbia's hair on purpose?
Well, of course, he was born in what is now Croatia, so I can see that they have a claim to him. I think Serbia is causing a bit of a fuss over what the most of the rest of the world would consider nothing, particularly as he actually spent most of his life in the United States, and of course there is a car named after him effectively as well. So had the Serbian complained to the Americans about the name of the car and the name of the factory?
I mean, they might.
They could. I think, you know, it's one of these things. It's very easy from a distance to say, oh, what a load of nonsense. But on the ground, suddenly these things can take on a huge significance. And I can see that it could cause a real row. I mean, also, of course, you know, from the breakup of Yugoslavia, I mean, think of the fuss there was about the name of Macedonia, also in that region.
I mean, with all due deference to the potential real-world tensions that things like that illuminate, I am a massive fan of this kind of pettiness. And I did want to ask the panellists, if you indulge indulge anything similar yourself? I mean, Stephen, I will start by asking you, because it seems pertinent to your Scottishness, that the other weekend, for example, during a certain football match, were you in fact clad from head to foot in blue and bellowing Forza Italia?
No, although I consider myself Scottish, but I have spent most of my life in England. So I have an affection for England. I have no affection for English football fans, having been, as I've mentioned in the studio, having been a volunteer at Euro 2020 and seen the behaviour of England fans, particularly at the semi-final and final, which was simply disgusting. I wouldn't have minded as much for that if England... England didn't win in the end, but I wouldn't have minded if they hadn't got to the final either. But no, I don't. I don't have sort of these die-hard views that it must be one or the other, and therefore, if you love one, you hate the other. I just think that's rather dangerous.
Well, Andrew, I have to say, if I can throw in my personal one before going for the next question, it would be from my Austrian side, half Austrian. Fight over the Mozart chocolate balls, Mozart Kugeln, between Germany and Austria, which I just find a fascinating dispute within Salzburg. There's all kinds of different ones, the original Mozart Kugeln, the echte, the real Mozart Kugeln, and then the Reber Mozart Kugeln that are made in Bavaria of all places and actually have the highest bit of revenue. I mean, can you imagine that?
See, there's a dessert or confectionery related one from my neck of the woods, which is this persistent and absurd claim by New Zealanders that they invented either or both the Pavlova or the Lamington. I mean, they just didn't. They're insane. They're crazy people. Natalia, is there any of this sort of thing in Latin America? Are there rival claims to the heritage of various things among the South American nations? Things that the Peruvians say are theirs, that the Bolivians say, no, it's ours, etc.?
Well, Peru and Chile have a very long-standing rivalry since Peru lost part of its territory. And that territory was where pisco, the national drink of Peru, is produced. There's a port of pisco in Peru, but Chileans registered it as a trademark in the 1980s. So it's a very, very hot dispute.
Wow, that's really heavy going. They actually registered it as a trademark.
They did. But symbols are very powerful, and pisco sour, our national drink, both in Chile and in Peru, is heavily disputed because the recipe is slightly different in Peru and in Chile.
But do you want to say on Monocle 24, which will make it official, that Peruvian pisco is the real thing and that the Chilean stuff is a pale and feeble imitation?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. We will be happy to deal with all the emails from our Chilean listeners. Natalia Sobrevilla-Perea and Stephen Diol, thank you both for joining us on the Monocle Daily, though we may hear more from you shortly after this, because finally it is time for today's episode of our series on the Olympic Games. For the duration of the Tokyo Olympics, some of Monocle's vastly international staff will be looking back to their favourite Olympic moment involving their home nation.
And for today's installment, Monocle's Chiara Rimella wanted to take us back to the hot summer of 2004 and muse on the joy of watching her home nation of Italy compete in one of the smaller events.
If I asked you to name a few of your favourite Olympians, who would come to mind? Probably Usain Bolt, Simone Biles, Tom Daley, Michael Phelps. Runners, gymnasts, divers, swimmers, the athletes who specialise in the big, bold, sexy disciplines. Unless you're a dedicated Olympic all-round fan, or your nation is historically good at a sport that most people would consider pretty niche, chances are that you will tune in primarily when the primetime headline events are on. But for every 100 people that just watched a 100-metre sprint final, there is one person like me who will sit through the entire thing back-to-back. Or rather, like the me of 2004, a bored teenager stuck at home with a pesky illness during a sticky hot Italian summer, positioned in front of the TV for the best part of the day. With the games being hosted in a time zone pretty close to where I was sitting in Turin, I could easily make sure I didn't miss a minute of the Olympics coverage. And I didn't.
Ladies and gentlemen, please be outstanding for the national anthem of Italy.
It turns out 2004 was a great year to be following Team Italy's efforts on our national broadcaster Rai. My home country ended up in a respectable 8th place in the table with 32 medals won, 10 of which gold.
Mark
Most Italians will remember Athens 2004 as the year when an Italian conquered the top of the podium for the men's marathon, winning it in the most symbolic of terrains, the birthplace of the marathon itself.
Va a Stefano Baldini! Bravo! Bravo!
Some others will remember the efforts of Valentina Vezzali and Aldo Montano, our superstar fencers. But the face of that edition of the Olympics for me is that of archer Marco Galeazzo. On the 17th of August, Marco Galeazzo was standing in the heat at the marble Panathinaiko Stadium, ready to fire his last arrow, and I was watching. Wearing a beige bucket hat, some thick-rimmed black glasses, and a hint of a goatee, he may not have looked like the most glamorous of contenders, but that has made his friendly face even more indelible in my memory. The Padua-born athlete was 21 at the time and at his first Olympics, facing Hiroshi Yamamoto, the decorated 42-year-old Japanese archer who was competing his last games.
Yamamoto! L'avventura che mai ti saresti aspettato.
When the final arrow landed for 9 points, the commentators, until then polite and genteel, as you would expect for as poised a discipline as archery, exploded into a celebration fit for a football World Cup final. The Robin Hood of Padua, they screamed. He has rewritten the history of Italian archery.
Medaglia d'oro Marco Galeazzo, guardate la calma! Il Robin Hood di Padova, medaglia d'oro!
That day, Galeazzo won the first ever archery gold for Italy. He went on to win another for the team event at London 2012, but I didn't see him win that. Truth be told, I never really followed archery again. But for that day, in 2004, I was a huge fan of the sport. Those who are into watching these smaller events at the Olympics will understand what I mean. That intense glimpse into a passion nurtured and trained away from the spotlight, at least most of the time, can give viewers an outsized sense of meaning and purpose. So bring on the shot put, the hammer throwing and the discus. We will always make time for them. For Monocle 24, I'm Chiara Romella.
Thank you very much, Chiara. We were just talking here in the studio about how each country has a very different focus when it comes to the Olympics and what they're watching. I personally remember being stuck in the UK watching curling for hours upon hours when the UK was doing fantastically well and couldn't get anything else on the days before streaming. Natalia, what about you? What have you been watching? What are some of the more obscure sports that catch your eye?
Well, this year there have been new sports, and Peru, that is not particularly Olympic nation, has been aiming for both skateboarding and surfing and managed to get quite high up but didn't quite make it. And it was very fun to see these new sports. And also I've been following the debate on soccer or football and how it should be adapted or not, if the big stars are not there. Interesting to see some of the upsets with tennis, gymnastics.
I just like watching those sports that I do not spare a single thought for most of every four-year cycle. I got massively into the sprint canoeing at the Rio Olympics for some reason. I'm not sure whether I can go through all that again. It gets quite tense.
I'm very old-fashioned, I'm afraid. I was listening today to, they were talking about the surfing and the skateboarding, and I'm thinking, and BMX biking. I think these are not Olympic sports. I'm sorry. And when when the Paris Olympics come up next, the surfing is going to be in Tahiti. I mean, that's not really bringing Olympians together, is it?
You can't surf in Paris. And I will say, just before we go, that Stephen Diel's cynicism there about the BMX racing, if anybody hasn't watched it, is entirely misplaced. That is mesmerising, in that somebody seems to have sat down somewhere and thought, let's think of a sport which will maximise the chances of fracturing the skulls of every single participant in it. It's fabulous to watch, and I believe it starts on Saturday. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our guests today, Natalia Sobrevia-Parea and Stephen Diel, Suzanne Lynch in Washington, D.C., and of course, Monocle's Chiara Romella.
Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Louis Allen, with editing assistance from Chris Ablakwa and Christy Evans. I'm Chris Chermak.
And I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.